Buongiorno e benvenuti al Economia in 10 con Pietro e Gavin. In each podcast, we'll be looking at famous economists and asking 10 questions that will hopefully inform you and get you thinking about their influence in modern society today. This is season 6 and our second one, so you know, hopefully you're going to enjoy it. And what kind of economist are we looking at today, Pete?
I'm always sort of flabbergasted. I always think you can't get worse in terms of your pronunciation of you know, foreign accents, but you do.
Can yeah. I just say, I looked up how to say 10 on Wikipedia, or went to Google. Dici.
Dici, yeah. Beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you.
You said it much nicer just when you said it then.
Yeah, buongiorno.
Yeah.
I did get taught that by Mrs. Conti at my school.
Oh, well done.
So yeah. Thank you,
genuine,
Mrs. Conti.
A genuine Italian teacher.
Yeah.
Today, we are looking at the life and ideas of Corrado Gini, who developed the Gini coefficient. And I must confess, if you're not familiar with the Gini coefficient, it's probably the most commonly used measure of inequality used today. For many, many years, I thought that Gini was an acronym, G-I-N-I. Yes. And I actually read an article the other day with someone else who said the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And then sort of did some research. And it's quite interesting because he came to the conclusion, actually, it's the reason why is because almost Gini has a slightly dodgy past. So it's almost like airbrushed out a little bit. And we just remember the Gini coefficient yeah. without actually remembering Corrado himself. So we're going to resurrect him, warts and all, tonight.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, we'll find out a little bit about his life and times. Not very much about his life, to be perfectly honest. Of all the economists we've looked at, his biography was possibly the scarcest.
Yeah, difficult.
But certainly the whole idea of inequality and the Gini coefficient, you could argue that after climate change, perhaps inequality is the most pressing problem facing not just the UK, but many other societies around the world. I guess we can discuss the relative importance of inequality later.
Well, we have got, obviously, a podcast on this, haven't we?
We have. We've got our inequality special, which listeners are very welcome to go back yeah. and listen to.
And if you remember from the start of that, they asked economic students all around the world what they thought was the number one priority in economics,
mm-hmm.
and it was inequality.
So, well, there, so there we are. So you asked initially what's the relevance of Gini. Well, certainly the topic of inequality, of which the Gini coefficient is bandied around a lot when people are discussing it, is of crucial importance to modern economic discussion. And I should say as well, we'd like to think tonight we're going to provide an oasis of calm. What in the economic world of the UK is a turbulent time.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah. people might listen to this in 2 years' time.
They might.
And it will be okay.
What are they talking about? We're now in the sunlit uplands.
Yeah, exactly.
Of
exactly.
trend growth of plus 2.5%.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, 2% plus.
2% plus.
Or 2.5%.
Yeah, who knows? Right. So a little bit of biography about Gini, first of all. And as I said, the details about his life are somewhat sparse, but he's born in the May of 1884 in Motta di Livenza, which may or may not be a worse pronunciation.
It sounded good to me.
Yeah, thank you. Just do it with confidence. Yeah. And to be honest, I did want to ask our Italian teacher, is it the Veneto region or the Veneto region of Italy?
I reckon Veneto.
Yeah. I was going to say Veneto. Anyway, it's a bit around Venice. Yeah.
Hopefully our Italian friends can tell us.
Hopefully they can.
If they haven't stopped listening already.
thrown down the headphones in disgust. So he's born into an old landed family to father Luciano and mother Lavinia Locatelli. Found it really difficult to find much in the way of references to his childhood. However, I did find one quote from one of his colleagues who felt that his upbringing had had an impact on his personality. So I'll read you the quote, partly because it's pretty much the only information I've got on his childhood. So, all his life, this country ancestry gave him something solid and withdrawn. He could be sociable when he wanted and a brilliant talker, but it cost him an effort which he made only on rare occasions, when the inner promptings, which always pushed him on towards some precise aim or either, relaxed their grip on him Oros demanded the effort in the ultimate interest of his ends and purposes. So I don't know what to make of that, really. Sort of solid and withdrawn, you know.
I get
sort
that. Of inner I confidence. Get that. I reckon if you're kind of an intellectual, not like we are, Pete. I mean, if you don't want to be dealing with buffoons, do you, all the time? And you kind of think, yeah. Oh, I'm going to have to be make an effort to be sociable.
It's like the country ancestry, I suppose. If you were born into a landed gentry, I suppose that must give you a certain amount of confidence, mustn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. And just think, why am I dealing with these people?
Yeah, sort of superiority. Superiority complex. I did read elsewhere his dad was also a manufacturer as well. Right. So perhaps that sort of sparked an interest in economics. Though the degree to which you could say he is an economist is sort of arguable.
Yes.
Perhaps more a statistician who sort of dabbled in some areas of sort of statistics, particularly demography.
Yes.
Which have relevance to economic discussions. So perhaps that's a better way of characterising him. So the only other biographical detail I could sort of hit upon was that he did marry Valentina Poggioli in 1921, and they had two daughters.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you get the impression he never saw them.
Yeah. So probably we should say a little bit, because, you know, I'm going to try and be charitable later on, because he does have some awful views, I would say, and certainly was involved in a fairly awful regime. But in terms of his time and place, Italy's as a modern country is only probably 13 years old when he's born, you know. So it's a really young country. You see the capture... Well, I'm sort of marking that as the capture of Rome in 1871.
Right.
Which is the culmination of the sort of period of the unification of Italy. Risorgimento, I think it's called locally.
Good, we're doing really well tonight.
So, in some respects, all of this is when he's a child, you know. The country is sort of not much older than him as a sort of modern state. And obviously, Italy as a sort of geographical area is the home to sort of an ancient, sort of enormously impressive civilization with the Roman Empire, which he sort of inherits, but it's been fractured for sort of many, many sort of centuries. So, Italy as a modern state... is a fairly new thing. And actually, it's only in 1866 does the Veneto region really become part of what we call Italy anyway. I mean, previously it had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Now, a quote for you here, or you can guess if you want. Who said, which famous statesman said, Italy is only a geographical expression?
I don't know.
Come on, have a guess.
Well, is it of his time?
No, it's a bit earlier, I think.
No, I wouldn't have a clue. I wouldn't have a clue. I don't want to show my stupidity, Pete.
Count Metternich.
Is he?
Well, to be honest, I'm not entirely sure. I think, to be fair, he was one of the architects of the Congress of Vienna, which was some sort of... a sort of peace conference which restructured Europe after sort of intercontinental wars.
So is that like claiming that it didn't actually properly exist?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a bit like Ukraine at the moment, when some Russians say that, don't they? Ukraine is just what did he say?
Italy is only a geographical expression. So in other words...
Would some Russians say Ukraine is just
possibly,
a geographical...
Yeah, well, possibly, yeah. But I mean, right. I suppose differently in that, you know... Italy was fractured amongst loads of sort of city-states and things that. But yeah, no, but there is a parallel there. And so the point in sort of bringing all of this up is that you could argue even today, people's regional identity in Italy is greater than their national identity.
Yeah.
Some of the politics in Italy even today surrounds that, like with the Northern League and things like that.
Yeah, I saw that with the breakdown of the voting, I think, for... the new lady who's just got in, Maloney.
Yeah.
Which we'll get onto.
Oh, will we? Oh, exciting. Yeah. So, I mean, you could argue, though, because it probably sort of jumping the gun here, but Gini does become associated with the fascist regime. But Italy, from a fairly early day, there is a whole issue of their sort of nationalism as a young sort of nation state. How does one identify... you know, with Italy as a country.
Mm.
And you could see there's a sort of fascist response to that. Oh, we're going to sort of create this sort of modern state, which is going to sort of echo some aspects of ancient Rome, certainly in its kind of aesthetic. But the question I was going to ask you in all of this is, do you consider yourself a patriot?
Hmm. Yeah, I'd like to think so.
Or a nationalist?
Ooh. Well, I tell you what I used to do. You know when they used to have to put your national... I used to put European, because I knew that would wind up a few people. You know, yeah. Collectively. But, you know, you're always proud of your roots, aren't you, a little bit?
Yeah, these issues of identity are interesting. By the way, I did sort of look this up, actually. I was sort of thinking, what is the difference between... Because, like you, I was saying nationalism, that doesn't sound good. Patriotism, I think I am patriotic in some sort of small way. But nationalism... Having or expressing strong identification with one's own nation, fine. Vigorous support for its interests, still kind of fine. Especially to the exclusion or detriment of the interests of other nations. The last bit, not fine.
Yeah.
For me.
Okay, I see that, yeah.
But then a patriotic is just devoting or having vigorous support for one's own country.
Well, I'm coming in, I'm patriotic. Kind of
yeah. So I think we're patriotic rather than nationalistic.
Would you... wave a flag if you were invited to the last night of the proms?
Yeah, why not?
So would I. Join in.
You'd have to be invited, by the way.
Obviously we wouldn't be invited.
You could just buy a ticket. Well, the great famous quote about sort of patriotism, and Steve, again, I'm going to ask you a question related to this.
All right.
A sort of famous British author, E.M. Forster. Have you remember the works of E.M. Forster?
No.
Yeah. You will be. Rumoured of you, seen that?
Yes.
Maurice?
E.M. Forster is one of those people who I never... is that a man or a woman? You know, sometimes you get confused, don't you?
It's a man. Yeah.
Man, okay. Good.
Okay, so quote from E.M. Forster.
Right.
If I had to choose between betraying my country and betraying my friend, I hope I should have the guts to betray my country.
Mm.
So where would you stand on that? You've got a choice between betraying... Britain or betraying me, you know. I've always put you on the spotlight.
Difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
What if you're spying? Is that kind of is
maybe,
it related to that?
Yeah,
what if you are betraying?
What if I am?
You could be. the way that you
could be. Sort of like, maybe
it's difficult. Yeah. I'll side with you, Pete.
Okay, well, that's very kind.
Yeah, that's all right. No worries.
Yeah, me too.
We can run off together.
Let's go down together. So, as I said, not much detail about his family. The other things I did find about him in his life, he had quite an unusual way of working. Did you read about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Jeannie's assistants and some other professors, and the mind does boggle with this, used to work in small glass boxes fitted with a microphone which Jeannie could use to listen and talk. But the occupier of the box could only reply if spoken to.
Yeah. He was a real taskmaster, wasn't he?
Ultimately. He was
proper on it, and you would not want to, and he was a workaholic, wasn't he?
Yeah, so this
he wrote so many papers, didn't he? Did you see how many phenomenal amount of papers?
Another colleague sort of said once during my first piece of work on the comparison between the purchasing power of salaries and wages, he went to Central America, and on his return 15 days later, he checked the number of numerical calculations I had made during his absence. And as he thought I had not worked enough, he threatened to sack me. He was not the type of person to threaten in vain. So basically, somebody he worked for, he came out and said, you're not done enough for sums.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, efficiency. I think he was all about efficiency, which, you know... I was thinking about this on the way over about...
What do you think about the glass boxes, though?
Yeah, it's odd.
Yeah, can you imagine that? You're not working like that.
Well, isn't that just the modern-day cubicle?
But a glass, you know, you can only be spoken to. It's quite extreme, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it is extreme.
So, anyway, he had a fairly sort of meteoric career. In 1908, he's granted Libera Docenza. I think that's how you pronounce it. It might be Docenza, I'm not sure. Apparently, this is some kind of sort of official thing which gives you access to teaching in universities.
Right.
And he takes advantage of that.
Yeah.
So by 1909, he's a professor of statistics at the University of Cagliari. See, I'm on home ground with Cagliari because when I used to watch Italian football in the 1980s and 90s, yeah. I remember how they pronounced Cagliari.
Good, well done.
And by he's only 26 years old in 1910. He's the chair of statistics at Cagliari. Yeah. He does also teach political economy. So that's kind of economics before economics, if you like. And he founds the first laboratory of statistics in Italy.
Right.
Yeah. And then he becomes the chair of statistics at the University of Padua. Have you been to Padua?
No.
I've been to Padua.
Right, nice.
Do you know one of the most impressive sort of historic / artistic experiences of my life in Padua? I went to the Scrivegni Chapel.
Yeah. All right.
Which has it's a series of paintings by a sort of pre-Renaissance artist called Giotto.
Right.
Have you heard of Giotto?
No.
Okay. And it's all kept in this kind of climate-controlled chapel.
Yeah.
Because the chapel was built by some sort of awful medieval sort of warlord who basically said, create this chapel so that people can pray for me for all the terrible things I've done. But really beautiful.
What were the pictures of?
Well, religious paintings. Like Jesus' life, stuff like that.
Beautiful. You've been to Italy quite a lot, haven't you, really?
I have, yeah.
Yeah.
But I'd recommend, if you are in Italy, you're in Padua, it sounds rubbish the way I've just described it, but the Scrivegni Chapel
it sounds
in Padua is very much worth visiting.
Mysterious.
Yeah, so he's a teacher at Padua. He also founds and directs, I think I've mentioned, the Institute of Statistics. In the same year, he founds an international journal of statistics called Metron.
Yes, which was kind of like a... Wasn't it kind of like a rival of...
Econometrica.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I think is still going. I don't know whether Metron is still going, but... Right. Econometrica, I'm 90% sure is still going. Yeah. Okay. I should know that, obviously, and I should read it regularly.
We'll get told if it's...
So I mentioned earlier, he marries in 1921, and they have two daughters. And it's around this time that fascism grips Italy.
Mm.
And so by 22, Mussolini's in power. Fascist policies are being imposed. And there is a sort of a coincidence of wants, for a better expression, between Gini and Mussolini, in that they are both interested in demography, the sort of science of population.
Yes.
Very possibly for different reasons. Gini's kind of interested in the evolution and equilibrium of population, with this comparison to sort of nations being like a biological organism.
Yeah.
Whereas Mussolini's sort of more interested in times in quite an extreme way, controlling sort of population. The sort of idea of sort of comparing societies to biological organisms is quite common around that period.
Right.
Sort of in sociology, you get the rise of sort of functionalist sociology and the idea of the organic analogy.
Well, he was a sociologist as well, wasn't he?
Yeah. Have you come across the organic analogy? So that's the sort of way you sort of compare society to the human body and sort of say, okay, the economy might be the lungs, the police might be the rib cage protecting the economy.
Yeah.
And things like that, yeah.
Hmm. What year was this? What were you into?
19th century. I'm not sure of the exact period. Because you get the sort of the start.
I was thinking about
sociology.
You know, when we did Marshall. And,
yeah.
And he was kind of inspired by the Darwinian kind of biology kind of aspects of it. So I wonder if it kind of linked a bit there.
We'll come on to that later, because certainly if you look at the sort of intellectual milieu in which not only Gini but others are operating, there's this interest in eugenics, which we'll come to. And he's certainly not alone in that. And some people some quite unexpected people, as we'll see, are, very interested in and advocates of eugenics.
Yes.
But we'll come to that later on. So, the years after World War One, Gini is involved in the problems of reconstruction in Italy. So, kind of his sort of expertise in statistics sort of leads him to being involved in solving economic problems to do with things like logistics, supplies of raw materials, control of inflation, war debts, labour issues and incomes. In some ways, there's parallels, bizarrely, with Keynes there. So Keynes was quite involved in a practical way with some of the sort of logistics of government rather than sort of being involved in is an elected politician.
But yeah, he was hands-on, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Skin in the game. Bring that back.
Skin in the game, yeah. So in 1925, he moves to the University of Rome as Professor of Economic Policy and Statistics. And from 1927, he's also teaching sociology and something called biometrics, which I suspect has a different meaning then than it does now.
Right.
I always associate biometrics with the little thumbprint kids have to do
at
my school to get their food.
Yeah,
do you
have
to do that at your school?
Yeah.
Yeah, thumbprints.
Yeah, I think so.
Bit of a kerfuffle when we first introduced that. We had the odd person saying, what's this data going to be used for? And things like that.
Now just a ready acceptance. It's because they do it all on their phone, don't they? Unlock my phone with a thumb.
Yeah, with my eyes.
Yeah.
But Mussolini, in 26, sets up a central statistical institute and personally appoints Gini to be its president and oversee its organisation. There's probably a much more of a greater confidence in government at that point, generally, and in this kind of technocratic approach to government. So you can see why governments of any ilk would be interested in someone like Gini. You know, his sort of mathematical genius, you know, I suppose, to be fair, whatever one thinks about him. But certainly by this point, Gini is advising Mussolini on demographic issues. So he writes 4 years after his most famous paper, Measurement of Inequality of Incomes, which is where we get the Gini coefficient from, he does sign the Manifesto of Fascist Intellectuals. And someone I read somewhere that he was the only statistician to do so. So what I inferred from that is there probably was a choice.
Yeah.
So he's probably quite an active proponent of fascism. Mm. It's not like someone who's, well, I don't know, I sit, you know, when you read more about him, you kind of, did he just go with the flow? Or was he kind of an active advocate of sort of fascism? And I sort of, the more I read about him, I thought more the latter.
Yeah, I was thinking that as well. Yeah. Unless there's a lot of backpedaling going on.
Well, loads of backpedaling after the war.
Yeah.
As you can imagine. But and he wrote a book, he wrote a treatise, The Scientific Basis of Fascism.
Yeah.
That's not someone sitting on the fence.
Yeah. It's quite interesting though. I think I've read that.
Have you?
Is just a small thing, isn't it? Maybe I've seen a speech by it. I read that.
Well,
I think.
Well, you've read a lot more than you normally do in preparation.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, but that scientific basis of fascism wasn't really, it was explaining why fascists come to power.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't much science. It was like political science, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I was about to say it's not very scientific at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just basically to do with, again, why voters allow fascism to happen, because, you know, this is a bit like, you know, again, the parallels to today about the building up of another, you know, and wanting someone to do something about it.
I don't think it was done in any kind of, oh, we must not allow this fascist thing to rise, though. It's pretty pro, I would say.
No. No, what I said is that you said about how people kind of just sort of went, you know what, I don't really like the situation at the moment, so I'm willing for this person to come in and just basically take control, no matter eventually what it turns into.
Well, you know, joking aside, that could happen very easily. I think if you look at America today, this doesn't alienate lots of our...
Mm.
There are some people who think, you know, you read some polls, you know, democracy...
Yeah.
You know, do we need it? You
know, no, that's the thing I think he was saying.
Yeah. So he founds in 1936 the Faculty of Statistical, Demographic and Actuarial Sciences. So he is a prolific, not only author, as you pointed out earlier, but also sort of founding sort of certain sort of intellectual foundations, you know, for good or ill. So I suppose we need to sort of flip back to the times in which he was operating. Italy enters the war following the German invasion of Poland. Not straight away. It's sort of after just before the fall of France, I think, Italy enters the war on the German side. 3 years later, the Allies invade Italy. And late that month, Mussolini resigns. And the fascist party in Italy was dissolved.
Hmm.
And so then you get the Allies slowly sort of fighting their way north. And then eventually Italy surrenders and they declare war on Germany, sort of change sides at that point. So Gini at that point is not in an easy position. He's been close to Mussolini and the fascist government. Some commentators sort of indicate that, oh, maybe he opposed some of their policies, particularly the more racist policies. But I've got a quote from him later on, which you kind of think,
I read a lot of that, that basically he was much more disagreeable with Mussolini than you first think. But like you're saying, when you actually read some of it,
but his own views, they're not pleasant.
Mm.
You just get a sense of someone who's sort of blowing with the wind so he can do the work that he wants to do.
Yeah. He's just interested, wasn't he?
Yeah, but there's not... some people took very brave positions during the war, both within Germany and Italy, and he's certainly not in that group.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's easy, A lot of people at the moment, just to give a sort of rough parallel, say, why aren't more sort of Russian sort of sportsmen, intellectuals, why aren't they more critical of Putin? They can obviously see that what's going on is wrong, assuming you have that position, which I do. But it can't be easy, it's not easy. But some people took positions that weren't easy. Gini did not.
Yeah.
And probably fairly actively, it's not like a passive position, I would say. I think he fairly actively took the side of the fascist regime.
Yeah.
It's not passive. And whether he did so out of just ambition, personal interest, well, so what? It's still not a credible position.
Yeah. You might argue, you sometimes have to dance with the devil to get things done.
Yeah. To a degree, yeah.
That was always Bob Geldof's chat about when he had to deal with the Ethiopian leader. He had to kind of ignore some of the kind of displacement.
What's he trying to do that's really good that by cozying up to Mussolini that allows him to do beyond pursuing his own intellectual interests?
I don't know. Maybe that intellectual interest might eventually benefit the world.
So anyway, during the summer of 1944, people are investigated for their role in the wartime regime.
Yeah.
It's not quite to the same degree as eventually happens in Germany, where you've got that period of sort of denazification.
Yeah.
But Gini is impeached during that period. But somehow he does survive. By 1946, he's back at the faculty.
Yeah.
1949, he's president of the Italian Statistical Society. And he holds that till his death,
And he gets invited all around the world, doesn't he? This is the kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what I found quite surprising, is that he might have been tarred.
Mm.
And yet, maybe it's just one of those things, a bit like, now you just get invited out of controversy kind of thing.
Yeah, so, I've heard him described in one, and I think this is quite, as an institutional entrepreneur, in terms of sort of... developing new institutions in Italy, school of this, school of that, and perhaps using the sort of the fascist regime, sort of piggybacking on that to do that.
Yeah.
But again, I don't think that's a particularly sort of credible thing to do.
Mm.
And you can see him certainly tacking back towards the winners, if you like, after the war, with some bizarre sort of affinity with a movement called Organicism. Did you come across that?
No.
Well, he was calling for, after the war, in quite something of a vault fast, shall we say, that Italy should be annexed by the US.
Oh, no, this is the Italian Unionist movement.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, they wanted to become the 49th state of the US, which did seem slightly odd.
To say the least. The parallel I thought, do you remember when William Hague was leader of the Conservative Party?
All right.
And he's like, I'm not saying he's a fascist, by the way.
No.
we haven't got any sort of legal protection for this podcast.
No.
But I remember him saying, I think the UK should leave the European Union and join NAFTA.
Really?
And he's thinking, yeah, but it's quite far away.
I want to do a William Hague impression. I think we should join NAFTA.
It's not your best impression. I'm trying to think what your best impression is, but ultimately, I think he's a bit of a shapeshifter,
Janie,
and I don't think that's good.
Yeah,
a
bit like who's the I know we don't do this question anymore, but as who Benicio, the guy in Star Wars?
Oh yeah,
dude.
The guy who shops. thin and...
Yeah. You don't know where they like... Yeah. But a bit like Lando. It's a bit like it in the original.
I don't think he's like Lando. I think he's more like the other guy.
Okay.
Because Lando comes good in the end.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Yeah. Lando else ends up as General Calrissian.
Well, yeah, yeah. Okay, well, we know that now.
Yeah, yeah. Genie did not end up sort of doing great and good things beyond pursuing his own intellectual interests.
Fair enough.
Right, anyway, so just if we're in any doubt about Genie and sort of his racism / fascism, because there is some sort of... Here's a quote from him. Negroes do not give the confidence to be ever... able to ever civilize themselves in the same way we do, and therefore they will never understand how much there is to do to exploit the immense natural resources of their land to the advantage of the entire humankind. Given such a condition, it is not fair that such natural resources remain unutilized, and civilized nations have the right to take possession of Africa just only for such resources. Now, I am sure there would have been people in, you know, sort of 19th century UK, England, saying things like that. Probably 20th century UK and so on. But you can't say on the basis of that, oh, you know, it was quite sort of like some kind of, you know, fifth columnist opposing the regime from within. He's a racist. You could argue he's of his time in some ways if you want to be kind about it. But he's that's a fairly sort of, you know, racist viewpoint.
Yeah. You can see how eugenics, though, is a natural kind of fit for economists, can't you? Do you know what I mean? In terms of, like, you know, obviously we teach all the time, you know, there can be problems. Scarce resources, unlimited ones. So how do you most efficiently use the scarce resources? You want to get the best quantity and quality of the factors of production. So therefore, the extreme of that is you want the best quantity and quality of labour, don't you?
Yeah.
So therefore, you then want to adapt the gene pool to get the best quantity and quality. So from an economics point of view, you know, it's you can see why people would kind of
favour that. You're in a very limited understanding at this point of genetics.
And there's still this view
of sort of... you know, the sort of visible sort of markings of ethnicity sort of being associated with some sort of intellectual deficiency, which we know now is nonsense.
Yeah.
But, well, there are still people in the 20th century who spout nonsense like that. But, you know, thankfully, I think in intellectual circles, at least, they're in a minority. You've got a whole, you know, intellectual sort of movement dating right back to some sort of... bastardization of Darwin's views. But actually, again, going back to sociology, there are sort of Italian criminologists who take this sort of simplistic approach to criminology, like, where, you know, the physical sort of characteristics of people can sort of indicate whether they're more likely to commit crimes or not. There's a guy, Lombroso, who used to measure the width of people's thighs, and apparently, you know, I think it might have been sort of fairly wide thighs.
Is that the classic thing as well about the size of the forehead?
Yeah, forehead, that? Yeah, that kind of thing.
Who came up with the word eugenics?
Ooh, I'm going to guess. I don't know. Aldous Huxley.
Francis Galton.
Oh, Francis, of course, yeah.
Yeah?
The founder of eugenic movement.
Yes, but he's...
I thought he meant the actual just word itself.
But yeah, that's the word
Galton
itself.
Himself.
Oh, yeah, okay, and it comes from eugenes... the Latin, I think, for good in birth or good in stock. What was Francis Galton in relation to Darwin?
Relative, but I don't know what relative.
He was his... cousin.
Cousin, right, thank you, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, the sort of you is often before good things, like euphoria.
Okay.
It's the same sort of etymological sort of derivation.
Yeah.
Right, so you've mentioned so
he what he was he president of the eugenics? Are you getting onto that?
I'm not going to say that much about eugenics, but you can if you want to. Do you want to talk?
Well, I think he wasn't he president of some eugenics association, because I read a speech he did at this thing.
Yeah,
but I might save it till the end.
Okay,
I take it because it comes into about the question I want to ask him.
Okay,
right.
But he was a eugenicist. There's no doubt about that. Do you want to sort of outline what your Genesism means?
Not really. Well, I
mean, why don't you tell the listeners your understanding of
it? My understanding of it is that you are trying to manipulate the population to the kind of people you think should be in it.
Yeah, and the sort of corollary of that is you rule out certain types of people as well, you know. Yeah. But to be fair to Genie, and I don't think I sort of want to give him too fair a crack of the whip. Some other supporters of eugenics, you know, are people we might consider as quintessential liberals. Keynes.
Yeah.
Beveridge Report fame. Churchill. The Webbs, like Beatrice Webb and so on. Irving Fisher.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is, but this is my point about economics and sort of, there's no morality in economics. Mm. If you are so focused on trying to solve that economic problem and get the most efficient labour, whatever, it is a natural area to explore because you want the brightest minds, you know, and you want the quality and the quantity of labour to be the best.
I can understand the logic of it, but it sort of jars with sort of modern sensibilities.
Yeah.
The most bizarre sort of person who apparently had an affinity with eugenicism was Helen Keller. Helen Keller's like the sort of blind and deaf person.
Oh, you kind
of think,
right,
how did she end up being a sort of proponent? I was thinking, how does that work? Yeah. Because you would have almost thought someone like that, blind, deaf, she's going to be sort of, oh, we don't want blind, deaf children sort of to be sort of carried through to the next generation. But apparently she was an advocate of eugenicism. Yeah. I think I've said as much as I can say about his biography. I don't know if you want to add anything.
Do you know when he died?
I've written that down somewhere, but perhaps you can tell me.
No, I have no idea. You know, because remember, it's my mum's favourite. She always wants to know, and I don't know.
I think it's about 1960. It's in the '60s.
Right. Okay. We'll take that.
Yeah. Sorry, I did write that down, but I can't find it now. And you know what? We do normally mention that. I feel like I've let the side down there.
Don't worry about it.
So what we'll go on and talk about is his key ideas. And the key idea, which the reason why we're doing the whole podcast, is his idea of a Gini coefficient. I think we've talked about his non-economic ideas, i.e. he was a eugenicist. You've mentioned as well his affiliation with organicism, which is this sort of Italian unionist movement which advocated for the annexation of Italy by the United States. I think that, by the way, does come from a kind of almost sort of fascist leaning. This is the most vigorous state in the world now, the United States. So Italy's just been defeated in this war. We've shown we're not as vigorous, you know, so therefore Italy should take us over. But part of me also thinks it's sort of creeping up to the people who could do a Nuremberg on me and lock me up for the next 20 years. Yeah, I might be wrong. So the Gini coefficient is built on the work of another economist, Max Lorenz, who came up with the Lorenz curve. So the Lorenz curve is a simple way of visualizing inequality, and the Gini coefficient turns the same information into a single number. So you can see the attraction of that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that partly explains why it's stayed sort of influential over many decades. It's a simple number. People can understand it fairly readily. Shall I explain the Lorenz curve first?
Do that.
I'll do it quickly.
Can I just say, I don't know if you're going to say this. Yeah. Apparently, Gini sort of did this because he was unhappy with Pareto's kind of calculations of inequality. That's what I read about the 80-20 rule and all this kind of stuff like that. And he just basically wanted a bit more.
I think Pareto was another enthusiastic fascist.
Yeah. But I think that's what spurred Gini on because he thought that
his Pareto work was shoddy.
Yes.
Yeah. Shoddy work by Pareto. Yeah. There we go. So going back to Lorenz curve, and I think I've mentioned this in our inequality special, so I don't want to go into too much detail here, but imagine a graph with a percentage of households on the x-axis and a percentage of income on the y-axis. So the maximum value on each axis is 100%. So the graph in effect is like a box. Yeah. Now, if you imagine that box, much easier to... If we had a YouTube sort of podcast, show this now. But imagine the box is bisected diagonally. That line is the line of perfect equality. And this would represent a society in which all income is distributed equally amongst each household. Now, the actual distribution of income in a society is pictured below as a kind of bowed curve. And the more bowed the curve, the further away it is from the line of equality, the more unequal the society is. Now, what the Gini coefficient in effect does is it turns that sort of information, it sort of compares the relative areas on that graph and enables you to come up with a number or a percentage.
Yeah.
You can either see it as a decimal fraction, like a number between 0 and 1, or sometimes it's expressed as a percentage. But a country with a value of 0 would be a country which is perfectly equal. So imagine we're all sat around. The way I always explain this to my classes is, imagine we've got a cake. If we've got a Gini coefficient of 0, everyone would get an equal slice of the cake. And if it's a value of 1, that's the other extreme of maximum inequality. So going back to our cake, I'd be eating it all.
Yeah.
And they'd be looking at me thinking, I want some cake.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, so is that okay?
Yeah.
So we're happy with those two analogies. In practice, obviously, countries sit between these two extremes.
Mm.
So to give some examples, South Africa is has a very high Gini coefficient of about 0.63. Iceland would be relatively low, at about 0.26. The UK, about 0.35.
All right.
Interestingly, pre-tax, it would be much higher,
right.
0.4, about 0.48.
Right.
And the reason I say that is, of course, you can address inequality through progressive taxation. And progressive taxation in the UK has the effect of significantly reducing, even with tax reforms of the last 20 to 30 years, it still significantly reduces the Gini coefficient. The US, even post-tax, has a Gini coefficient of about 0.41. So it's a more unequal country than the UK. You can apply, by the way, the same methodology to look at wealth inequality as well.
Right, okay. I also saw, when I was looking this up, it's applied to loads of areas. I wrote down education, mm-hmm. opportunity, which apparently is linked to like Sen and his capabilities approach.
Right.
You can do a Gini coefficient for that. And dating.
Yeah, so go on about tell me about dating. Interesting.
Well, apparently
so distribution of dating opportunities.
Yeah, apparently on particular apps, how many like the most attractive people will get like a huge amount of opportunities to date people, while there'd be people, or is it evenly spread? Yeah. So it depends on like the kind of app that you get.
Interesting.
So there you go. So it can be transferred to many different areas, but obviously we're more focused on inequality of wealth and income, aren't we? And that you were saying about, obviously, post, what was it, working out an inequality in terms of after gross and net pay, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's interestingly, even, you know, the Gini for disposable income, and ultimately that's the one that really matters, you know, the income people take home every month, has risen significantly, for instance, in the 1970s. So everyone slags off the 1970s, but...
yeah.
It's a much more equal sort of period.
Yeah.
So at that point,
if you think it matters, I mean, this is the big discussion at the moment in the UK. Does inequality matter?
Yeah.
And what did she say? For far too long, we've been concerned about the inequality within the UK rather than chasing for growth, didn't she? That's kind of what she said.
Yeah, or that's distribution. Our glorious leader for the moment, Liz Truss. You mentioned earlier, if you're listening in 2 years' time, I will be astounded if she is still our glorious leader in 2 years' time.
Oh, we'll wait and see.
Well, we'll wait and see.
Yeah.
And if I'm wrong, you know, I think I should add some sort of notes to our podcast.
Yes, we will do.
I want to apologise. So just to give you a few more sort of little factoids, which I think are interesting. Again, since the 1970s, the Gini coefficient for retired people has gone up from about 21 to 30.7. So quite a polarisation within that particular sector of the economy.
I assume with auto-enrolment, that will then start coming back down, won't it?
Possibly.
Right. If you know, sorry, auto-enrolment is where now everyone has to sign up basically to a pension unless they opt out.
Yeah. Right. Wealth inequality in the UK, as one might expect, is much higher. Right. But it is in most countries, to be fair. You know, wealth is much more unequally distributed than incomes. Does vary quite, wealth, by the way, varies enormously in the UK. Sort of, apparently, the South East, excluding London, has about twice the wealth of the North West. Many multiples times the wealth of the North East.
Yeah.
Which probably should say, particularly for our sort of A-level listeners, again, I know we've said this before, income is what you earn, so it's like a flow. Wealth is what you own, so that could be shares, houses, and so on.
Yeah.
And the distribution of wealth is significantly higher than in terms of, so significantly more unequally distributed compared with incomes.
Yeah. And there's a bit, I mean, and who's it? In Scotland, where, you know, huge wealth inequality because there's so much land, isn't it, owned by the Scottish.
So, I mean, in terms of impacts, because I know we're digressing somewhat here, and I know we have talked about this before in previous podcasts, but there's an organisation called the Equality Trust, which is founded by the authors Pickett and Wilkinson, who sort of authors of what?
Spirit Level.
The Spirit Level, yeah. So they've looked at how sort of inequality affects sort of a number of spheres. And this one's interesting at the moment. In the economic sphere, less equal societies have less stable economies. You know, economic stability, financial crisis, debt, and inflation. You kind of wonder, is that partly sort of underpinning what we're seeing now? And certainly unequal societies have less social mobility, lower scores in maths, reading and science, which is surprising. I mean, again, the UK has become more unequal, but it's still sort of more equal than many sort of developing societies. And the other thing I think we pointed out in sort of one of our podcasts is that certainly it's a more equal society than historic British societies, like in the 19th century and things like that.
Yeah.
But it is more unequal now than our relatively recent past, you know, the 1970s. So again, going off some of the findings of sort of Pickett and Wilkinson, crime, apparently inequality increases property and violent crime. There's a little factoid here. Reduction of inequality from Spanish levels to Canadian levels would lead to a 20% reduction in murders and a 23% reduction in robberies.
Wow.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to, you kind of wonder what the methodology is behind that. And there are critics, by the way, of Pickett and Wilkinson's work, mainly from sort of white right-wing sort of think tanks.
Yeah, I said that before. I think that the IA brought out one called The Spirit Delusion, which was a direct attack on it.
Yeah.
So, and now they're running Truss's government, you could argue, but that's a different matter entirely.
It is, yeah.
So,
yeah, and so, I mean, I could go on, but there's lots of sort of...
The importance of Gini, what we're trying to get to here, is that he created this number that we can use to devise policy making. If you can care about it, you can look at it and think, right, what's my Gini coefficient? I see it's that. Maybe I can target that number. Actually, that's a good point, actually. You know, when we think about economic objectives, it would be interesting, wouldn't it, to say, for a government to come out and say, right, our Gini coefficient at the moment is this.
Yeah.
We're going to target this number. Why would that not happen?
Yeah, I can't think of an instance in which that has happened. Governments do target poverty, but they've never targeted inequality.
And yet we teach it as something that we should care about. Yeah. And yet, you know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, you wouldn't hear at the end of the news story, would you? Our Gini coefficient this year has gone up.
The statistics.
Yeah, exactly. It really. Yeah. Isn't it weird how we pick and choose our economic indicators?
Talking about that just today, you know, the inadequacies of GDP as a kind of sole target of government policy. I was teaching about that today. And the sort of work of Layard and Easterlin and, you know, regarding sort of happiness as a target.
Yeah.
Anyway, should we move on? Or should we do our sort of next round?
Criticisms?
Yeah, we'll
move on. Oh, no, well, hold up. I was going to talk about population a bit more.
Oh, were you?
Okay. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Because he when we did Ibn Khaldun, he talked about the rise and fall of empires.
Yes.
Right. And in many respects, there's a little link here.
There is.
To Genie. Because he was kind of obsessed about the Italian domestic population, as it were, being overrun by immigrants.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he then devised a load of policies.
Yeah.
And I think I wrote it down here. So that basically, why do countries rise and fall? It's because eventually there's not enough of them to fight off the kind of incoming lot. And so he said that what you should do is need to incentivize families to have children. So I was thinking that your family would have been loaded in Mussolini's era. But what they did is that they did competition in different districts to see who could have the most kids. And you got like a financial reward for it. Jobs favored those who were married with kids. They put additional taxes on bachelors.
Right.
So they created an environment that they felt. Now, the reason I bring this up, because obviously this is a kind of you know, them versus us kind of stuff.
Yeah. And it was an analogy. Ancient Rome, they did this as well.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Augustus tried to give some kind of incentives to have larger families.
Yeah, well, and this is the thing.
Amongst the patrician class. He felt like posh people weren't having enough kids.
Well, I suppose it's probably eugenics again, isn't it? Yeah. It's a kind of an early form of that, isn't it? Yeah. But that's the thing about, you know, who's the lady again who's just got into power?
Maloney.
Yeah, who's talking about, I am the... once you said something famous about, I'm a mother, I'm an Italian, I'm of this kind of earth or whatever, naturalist or whatever. And recently I read Barbara Walters' book. It was called, what was it called? How Civil Wars Start, and in brackets, How to Stop Them. And it's fascinating because it's all about how do you manage the transition from what you would see as being a kind of a local population for when globalization occurs, and then you've got kind of more immigrants coming in, and then manage that scenario. And then obviously what we've seen now is that you've got kind of this land of their fathers kind of thing in, like, you know, like rural America versus urbanized. Yeah. And it's the same in, I think, in Italy. I think there's that kind of rural versus urban kind of gap and all this kind of stuff like that.
North versus south. There's all
but it's like, how do you manage that transition? And is one way of managing the transition, quite controversial, is to encourage the population of, you know, people, you know, the Italian population.
The indigenous population.
Exactly.
Right,
to have more children. So then there's this kind of a more of a slow drip through of multiculturalism. And I know it's quite controversial to say.
I don't know. I mean, the irony is, certainly with respect to Genie, sort of advocate, Italy should be annexed by America.
Yeah, no,
built on immigration.
And that's what I don't...
And actually, to go back to the sort of forebear of, you know, Mussolini was massively sort of attracted to the aesthetic, certainly, of ancient Rome. But ancient Rome found a way of sort of assimilating different peoples into the sort of the Roman Empire, as it were. You know, and you're all, you know, even you go back to the New Testament, you know, St. Paul was a Roman citizen.
Yeah.
So he could appeal to anyone, Roman citizen could appeal, but he was a Jew, you know, he's a Jew from...
It's interesting.
Modern day sort of.
On that note, actually, I saw a little Reagan video today where he was talking about that, about America. He says about how someone had said to him, I don't know what he was quoting, about when people go to America. No, he goes, when you go to a particular country, you can't call yourself X, Y, or Z. Yeah. But when you go to America, you become an American. And, you know, it's kind of weird, like, this Republican president of that era kind of saying that, given what's kind of happened now in terms of immigration in America.
You know, just to go back to Italy, I just go back to what I was saying right at the outset. You know, Italy's such a young country. The idea that, you know, I've been generation upon generation Italian, you're thinking, no, you haven't. You know, the modern Italian state is not old, you know. It's not...
I wonder if that's the thing, though, if you're a young country, that you are... ultra protective,
More nationalistic, rather than more sort of just
There you go. Anyway, I was fascinated by the population stuff. Yeah. And especially because at the time, like I was saying, I was reading How Civil Wars Start. And, you know, there was a real kind of parallels. Also, at the moment, I've just been reading Charlie Robertson's The Time Travelling Economist. And he is talking about, a chapter is, what is the kind of Goldilocks moment when it comes to population? So he says, like, the problem in the developing world, as it were, is that they have too many kids. And so they've got to get down to like 2.5 to 3 in order to make sure that there's enough savings that can then be kind of taken from banks to be invested into long-term growth.
Interesting.
And it's a brilliant chapter of the book, really fascinating to think about. And yet here we are in Italy, like trying to get their population levels up. And we know now about Italy, don't we? Their replacement level is...
Yeah, it's terrible. We've got an ageing population. It's partly
like 1.7 or something, or like no one's having kids over there. Yeah. But anyway, I thought it was interesting because you could probably use that now. But there you go, right. So, what do the critics say about Genie?
Okay, so it's quite a funny quote I read here. Frank Cowell, who's an economist at the LSE, says the Genie coefficient is like the Kardashians. It's famous for being famous. So there are critics of the sort of technical aspects of the Gini coefficient. Apparently it's more sensitive to inequalities in the middle part of the income spectrum. I suppose the original Gini coefficient, with its focus on sort of income, maybe less important than wealth. But the problem with wealth itself is harder to measure accurately. And sometimes you do find that economics people focus on certain metrics because they're easy to measure rather than they're the right metric.
Right.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And you could see that even with, well, let's focus on GDP because it's easier to measure. Not as easy to measure, but certainly easier to measure perhaps than happiness. Some people see it as a bit of a distraction. Apparently Turkey and the US have very similar Gini coefficients.
Right.
And you kind of think they're not, you know, Turkey's got a vastly sort of inferior GDP per capita. So why would you focus on inequality? You know, would you not be better? Well, this is kind of a Trussian argument, growing the pie, rather than sort of thinking about how the pie is shared. I suppose like any economic statistic, there's a case of garbage in, garbage out. You know, it depends on how good the statistics about income and population are. There's quite a strong defense of Gini by a World Bank blog by a chap called Francesco Ferreira. You know, just said, all right, it's got flaws, but it is really useful still.
Okay, well, we'll get that out to our listeners.
Yeah, single measure of inequality. I think there definitely are critics, and there's also people who advocate alternative sort of measures of inequality, which they see as more sophisticated, like the Palmer ratio.
Yeah, I think that Branko
Milanovic,
I think he's developed a new one, you know, that is obviously trying to measure it a bit more accurately, he would argue.
And some people say, you know, the Lorenz curve, there can be sort of interweaving Lorenz curves, you know, it's not sort of like this kind of smooth sort of bow, and that's ultimately what the Gini coefficient is based upon. I think ultimately, what, if you can summarize the criticism, the single statistic, one could argue, is too simplistic.
Yeah.
You say all of that, but it's still, you know, is it not helpful to sort of to make those comparisons both across countries and over time? Yeah. There's surely some value in that, crude as it might be.
Yeah, a bit like we do with GDP per capita or whatever it might
be. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Anything else? I suppose the fact that he was a big eugenicist.
But like I said, there's some bizarre sort of... I still can't get over Helen Keller being a eugenicist. Yeah. I'd love someone to explain that to me.
Let it go.
Yeah. Okay, so that was very brief. But I think we've trodden that ground somewhat already.
He was a difficult man, I think.
To be honest, of all the economists we've looked at, I'm not sure I liked him.
Well, we'll get on to that at the end. But when I painted him, he looks gruff.
He does. It might be your painting. He came with a very long face.
Yeah, well, you know, that's I was trying to find the inner him. Okay, it's food time. What are we eating today, Pete, that has a spurious link with Genie? We've recently been to Italy, and at this point, I'd like to do a shout out to the Sherlock Holmes of Dough, who's following me on Instagram,
right,
who works at La Travista Pizzeria in Forio. Right. Amazing pizzas, but that man is a proper artisan of dough.
Well, there we are.
With the, is there any shout outs you like to do? Because you went to Roma over the summer,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, what was the food like over there?
Yeah, it was fabulous. I mean, I actually sort of stayed just north of Rome. I'm not sure I can remember any of the specific restaurants we went to. We stayed somewhere called Colavecchio, which was lovely. Yeah.
Right.
It's quite rural, sort of about an hour's drive from Rome. But yeah, I couldn't sort of name check any restaurants
La Travista.
Like you've just done.
Pizzeria in Forio. Please go and check him out. Yeah. He's a lovely guy. And if you go there, you'll find an Economics in 10 badge.
Wow.
On the, potentially on the wall. Anyway, what are we eating that's probably going to give me gout?
Well,
I say that, sorry, when I went to Italy in the summer, I suffered hugely from gout afterwards. A lot of shellfish.
Well, we were saying earlier about like Italy, you know, as a geographical expression. I mean, there's a huge variety of cuisines across Italy, reflecting the fact of this sort of patchwork quilt of a country that Italy is. So Gene is from the Veneto region, or the Veneto region. Yeah. I'm still not established well there. So I did look at something called a sand cake.
Interesting.
Which seems to be like it's a sweet treat, but made with potato flour.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so maybe it would have a certain grainy texture.
Yeah, like semolina.
I did debate making you that. But I am slightly obsessed at the moment, as you know, with Stanley Tucci.
Yes.
I think everyone loves Stanley Tucci. Men want to be him.
Yeah.
Women want to
be with him.
Yeah, and some men want to be with him. Yeah. I definitely want to be him, particularly as you get into, you know, the autumn of one's years. Yeah.
And he mixes a mean cocktail as well, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. Do you know what? I made a Negroni last week. Have you ever made a Negroni?
No.
Yeah.
Cocktails aren't my thing, really.
Oh, I love a good cocktail. Yeah. So I made a Negroni for the wife and I. But I did.
What's in a Negroni?
A Negroni is vermouth, gin.
Yeah.
And what's the orange cocktail in it? I want to say Cointreau.
Yeah.
It's not Cointreau. What is it? Campari.
Thank you.
Campari, yeah. Those three things, all in equal measure. It's just pure alcohol.
Oh, is it? There's no mixer?
Yeah, no mixer.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, chuck one of them down here on a Friday night. I'll take the edge off.
You need it at the moment. Keep warm. Just to keep warm.
Just to keep warm. That'll be the next Chug Government information campaign.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just selling cheap gin. Let's go back to the 19th century. Yeah?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Warm your homie, have a Negroni. I've just come up with a government slogan
that's
there.
Wonderful.
Brilliant.
But in Venice itself, and I saw this on the Stanley Tucci show, he sort of walks around, he goes around various parts of Italy and sort of tries the local cuisine there. Huge variety. But when he goes to Venice, which is in the Veneto region, obviously, he has these sort of like little tapas dishes, like tapas, but called cicchetti, I think they're called. Yeah?
Yeah.
Have them for breakfast, apparently, even.
Right.
With white wine.
Nice. For breakfast?
Exactly, yeah. I think that would be the beginning of the end for me.
Yeah, it would.
I've got a fairly strict rule that I don't have any alcoholic beverages before 6 p.m.
Right, okay.
Do you have that, or?
I thought you were going to say I have a strict rule that I don't have any alcohol with my breakfast.
Well,
before 6, so fair dues.
But anyway, one of the cicchetti he made
was
a kind of, well, you'll see in a minute, but it's like, it's mozzarella and mushroom wrapped in ham.
I'm excited. Treat. Let's get out of here.
I did trial it on the wife last night, and she's normally fairly sort of unhappy with some of the things I make you, but she said, oh, that's really tasty.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll go and get that for you.
Get it.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, you're supposed to drink it with white wine. Would you like a drink?
Yeah, go on, why not?
I tell you what I'll give you is a little marsala.
Thank you.
It's strictly speaking kind of like a dessert.
Yeah, yeah.
But why not have one with
it? Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you might like it. Yeah. So, back in the room with our cicchetti.
Yeah.
So like I said, Gav, it's got prosciutto.
Yeah. I'm cutting into it now. Yeah.
Wrapped around mozzarella and mushroom.
Yeah.
So, let me know what you think.
Yeah, that's lovely, that.
Yeah, I really like these, actually. I think cicchetti could be anything, almost like little tapas, or if you go to the Basque country, pinchos.
Yeah.
Or just, little sort of little meals. I remember going, have you ever been to Bilbao?
No.
I'd really recommend going to Bilbao. The food there is astonishing. Right. Went to San Sebastian as well, or Donostia in local tongue, and they've got a similar sort of thing. You can kind of almost go on a little sort of posh pub crawl. You wander around, have a little glass of wine and a little sort of savoury sort of treat like that. But yeah.
Well, that was delicious.
Good.
Very salty.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. That's why you'd need the white wine to wash it down.
Yeah, I'm going to just have a little taste of the masala. Was it masala?
Masala, yeah.
What up?
Yeah. Well, do you know the Veneto region is sort of the home of Prosecco as well, apparently?
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, thank you very... Well, you asked me that question.
Yeah.
You know what it is?
Well,
it's quiz time. Okay. So...
Well.
Here we go. Now, obviously, I don't want to be too...
That's why you're waffling on. I'm going to try that.
Yeah, no, you get stuck in. I don't want to be too, what's it called, stereotypical.
Mm-hmm.
But what should the quiz be about?
Italy.
Pasta, okay.
Oh, pasta.
So, here we go. Quiz, 5 questions.
Okay.
2 are multiple choice.
Right.
Are you ready? At the Edinburgh Fringe Festival,
right,
this was a joke. I tried to steal spaghetti from the shop, but the female guard saw me and I couldn't get pasta.
Yeah.
Okay. That one, joke of the Edinburgh Fringe.
Right.
Who was the comedian? Was it Masai Graham, Tim Vine, or Olaf Falafel?
I'm going to say Olaf Falafel.
It wasn't.
Who was it?
It was Masai Graham. Apparently he's won the joke of the fringe twice.
Hmm.
Question 2. What type of pasta has a butterfly shape?
Farfalle.
Correct.
Yeah.
Is that how you say it?
I think so. I don't know. Might be farfalle.
Very good. What is the most popular brand of dried pasta in Italy? Is it Napolina, the Cecco, or Barilla?
The Cecco.
It's Barilla.
Well, I didn't know that.
There you go. Question 4. Which Italian city is pasta carbonara from?
Is there not going to be choices?
No.
Rome.
Yeah.
Oh.
And
you know what? I think listening to Stanley Tucci's taste... sort of audiobook.
Yeah,
help me with that. I'm pretty sure he had a great one in. He swore a lot when he ate, actually.
Did
he? Saying the F bomb.
In a positive way.
Yeah, no, just describing how much he liked it.
Very good. Like, I should maybe do that about your food, Pete.
You should, yeah.
Give us a bit of an edge.
We could always get Nick to beat it out. We're a clean podcast.
Yeah, we are. In which country was pasta first made?
First made?
Yeah.
Some kind of trick question here. I know it was made in the UK earlier than one might think.
Right.
And obviously, as we discussed, Italy's just a geographical expression.
Yeah.
I've got no idea. I'm going to go... Well, Italy didn't exist, did it?
Right.
Like, when it was made.
Yeah. Where were things often first made? And you go, oh, really?
China.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Anyway, that's it. So you got 3 out of 5, Pete. Well done. So let's see if our listeners can beat that.
I feel like high-fiving you because that's better than I've done for some time.
That is good. Now, can I just say I was inspired by that first joke to write my own joke.
Right.
Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, go on.
And I hope our listeners like this. What's an Italian's favourite electoral system?
First past the post.
Yeah. It's good, isn't it? First past the post.
Yeah.
Anyway, right, we'll move on. Okay. Everyone is interested in the next Bond, okay, and who's it going to be? And it's exciting because it's probably coming up soon.
Mm.
Okay. We were wondering about whether our economist would make a good Bond. What do you think, Pete?
No.
Oh,
I think he's a good Bond villain.
Yeah.
He's a Bond villain, isn't he? He's kind of some Spectre henchman who Bond kills on a train.
Bond sticks in a,
yeah,
you know, he gets put in a glass Perspex box.
Yeah, and he makes a job.
I hope you're working, Mr. Bond.
He tries to put Bond in a glass Perspex box first, and then Bond somehow turns the tables.
Yeah,
and Genie ends up in a black in a Perspex box.
Yeah,
exactly. It's like going underwater or something.
Ah, Genie, I have you all boxed. I know, something rubbish. Okay, so that's a straight no.
Yeah.
Okay. What books would we recommend if people want to learn more about Genie and his ideas or ideas surrounding him?
Okay. So for me, I think we've mentioned this before, but if you want to read about inequality and the impact of the spirit level by Pickett and Wilkinson, and there is a rebuttal, as you've said, by the IEA, the spirit delusion. If you want to, you know, get into that sort of modern day BBC thing of equivalence.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed, actually, just in parallel to reading about Genie, and I didn't sort of take it all in, as you probably know from the ignorance which I displayed throughout the podcast so far. A Concise History of Italy by Christopher Duggan.
Okay.
I read that as listened to that as an audio book.
Love it.
Really interesting. It's sort of, you know, about, you know, I've sort of talked a while about the youth of Italy as a state and sort of how it came into being and the different conceptions about what the modern Italian state should be like. You know, really interesting. And also, I've mentioned it already, but we can send out a link to this, a sort of defense of the Gini coefficient by Francesco Ferrera.
Right.
It's not a defense of Gini, but of the coefficient as a useful tool.
Yeah, we couldn't find much really about Gini, could we? As a kind of a biography or whatever.
No, maybe other people can suggest.
Yeah, that'd be really good.
Sources, because we did struggle.
Yeah. I've already said two books today. Charlie Robertson's The Time Travelling Economist.
Yeah.
I mean, just talking about population generally, which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
Barbara Walters, How Civil War Start. But obviously, if you're interested in your kind of modern day eugenicsy type stuff, Angela Sain has got a book called Superior, The Return of Race Science.
Right.
Which is quite an interesting book. And I haven't read this one yet, but I'm going to put it on my Christmas list. I have read one of his previous books, Adam Rutherford's How to Argue with a Racist.
Oh, right, yeah.
He's brought out a book called Control, The Dark History and Troubling Present of Eugenics.
Right.
And apparently it's a fantastic book. It's quite a small book.
Yeah.
But apparently an excellent book.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, it does sound really interesting. So there you go. All right, so quite a few books there just to think about. Okay, if Genie was a boxer, what would his walk-on music be and why?
I did struggle with this, but I came up with Living in a Box by Living in a Box. Classic 80s.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good one, actually. Yeah.
I struggled after that. What did you call it? Well, it's quite a good tune, though. Living in a Box.
Yeah.
I'm living in a box.
Well, I went for We Don't Need This Fascist Groove Thing.
Oh, yeah. Heaven 17. Brothers, sisters.
Exactly.
We don't need this fascist groove thing.
And I thought we should select
some
Italian.
I'm not sure he'd come on to that, though. But maybe he would at the end of World War II. But look, I'm not a fascist.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to go to prison.
Really embrace it.
I just want to write about statistics.
Now, Maneskin. Do you know Maneskin?
I don't know Maneskin.
They're the one who won Eurovision in 2021.
With
the song Zitti e Buoni. I've probably said that one, which is Quiet and Good, which is a proper rock song.
Yeah.
I can imagine him coming onto that.
Yeah.
Now, one thing we haven't mentioned, Pete, which I thought you might find, and I found this hilarious, is that he believed in the abominable snowman.
How did you find that out? I didn't come across that at all.
Yeah, it's true. He was absolutely obsessed with the abominable snowman.
I quite like the abominable snowman as a kid. I used to have this book called... Something Mysteries but it had the Abominable Snowman.
Oh, was that you Choose Your Own Adventure? As an Abominable Snowman Choose Your Own Adventure book?
No, but it had all kinds of stuff like that about the Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant. As a kid, I was like, this is
Genie genuinely believed in Abominable Snowman and like wanted to find it and hunt it down and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And so I typed in Abominable Snowman songs.
Yeah.
And there's a really weird one by Jean-Michel Jarre.
Oh, right, okay. Mm.
Listen to it, it's quite interesting. Yeah. What are we going to go for? I think we should go for the Italian song.
Yeah, okay.
Maneskin.
Yeah, well, I think he would appreciate that.
Yeah, exactly. Right, Poetry Corner, Pete.
Right.
You can say the first two lines, and then I'll take over. There's okay. The first two lines there.
Who's the economist from Italy that measured inequality?
Corrado Gini is the man you seek. Thought Mussolini was kind of peak. We assumed he ate lots of spaghetti whilst thinking about finding a Yeti. A harsh teacher, he wrote lots and lots, trying his best to connect the dots between failed states and demography, plus a load of maths and sociology. He's best known for the Gini coefficient, which many argued was sufficient for measuring the difference between rich and poor, with anywhere from 0 to 1 being a score. And now this rating is used today to look at countries such as Norway and ask questions like, what do they do to help the many and not the few? Assuming, of course, you want more equality, but some economists just wouldn't agree.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. I liked your use of Norway.
yeah, it's a little bit
ropey.
Forced,
but you've got to do these things.
Thank you. So, do we like him? Would we have a beer with him?
I don't think I did like him. I think, you know, we take him out. I think we take him out and tease him a bit.
Yeah.
Maybe put him in a Perspect box and sort of tease him.
Well, he'd have, like, at that square at the start, he'd have to make a real effort to like us, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
And to come out with us and be like, oh, not Pete and Gav.
Yeah. No, I don't think he would. I was reading somewhere about some sort of Tory MP who was a sort of fellow Bullingdon Club member at Boris Johnson. Apparently put him in a box and pushed him down a hill.
Oh, really?
Maybe we could do that with Genie.
Nice. Well, I mean, I felt the Abominable Snowman, in many respects, gives us hope.
So we could
go on a little...
Yeah, little adventure.
Sort quest.
Of Canada.
Yeah.
Where Sasquatch.
Yeah, and hunt. Yeah. And hunt.
Hunt. Yeah. But I think I reserve the right to put him in a Perspect box and push him down a hill.
Yeah, you can. Okay, that's fine. So, new question alert for this season. If we were out with him, what one question would you ask him and why?
Okay, so I've got a few here. Right. One question.
Oh, yes, yeah,
can
one
I have a few options?
You can say the options and then choose the one you'd ask.
Okay. So what is the optimum level of inequality? Is there an optimum?
Nice.
Because in some respects, economists say, oh, you know, we want society to be more equal. Oh, no, you need a certain inequality to provide an incentive structure. Just wondered if you had a view on that. Or whether his work would be just sort of completely... I don't know whether you would see that as just a completely irrelevant question. Does he still think the USA should take over Italy?
Nice.
Or Italy should be annexed by the USA?
Good.
Does he have any regrets? You know, I feel like he should have regrets, but he doesn't. Yeah. So,
yeah.
I think probably, if I wanted to ask him a technical question, probably the only one he'd respond to would be optimal level inequality. I just imagine he would have a view.
Yeah, fair enough.
What about yourself?
Well, this is what I'm going to come back to when he was the president or whatever of the Eugenicist Society and he did this maiden speech or something like that. I'll tweet it because I've got the link somewhere. And he ends the speech with, you know, basically, all I know is that when we're trying to get the heart of this, it's like a Liz Truss moment. He goes, what we need is facts, facts, facts.
Right.
That's how he ends the speech.
Yeah.
And what I would be interested in now is... given what we know, if he had read someone maybe like Adam Rutherford's book or whatever, like the latest research on eugenics, would we, a bit like, you know, the real question is like, is that enough facts for you to kind of say, you know what, now that we've learned all this?
Because it's interesting. We talked about Keynes being a eugenicist earlier, but the classic Keynes quote, rightly or wrongly attributed to him, when the facts change, I change my mind, what do you do, sir?
Yeah, and that's the game.
Think, would he?
But that's the game. The other thing that sort of gave me a little bit of hope with him, the fact that he was a scientist. So if someone came along and went, mate, we've proved that hypothesis wrong, and he'd go, yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
You've provided me with the facts.
I get your point, but I think facts can only take you so far.
Yeah.
In the sort of world of the social sciences, you know, a certain amount of morality and values has to inform, you know, what you pursue and how you pursue it. I don't know.
Well, we'll never know. But it'd be nice to ask him.
Yeah.
Right. That's it, I think. Oh, yeah. No, who is it next time and what's happening?
So, I think we talked about maybe doing another special episode.
Yeah.
Or we did talk about Irving Fisher.
We're definitely doing Fisher next as an economist. It's whether we squeeze in a fiscal policy special.
Do you know what I'd like to do at some point in the relatively near future?
Yeah.
I'm chucking this in, which I've not even talked to you about before.
Yeah.
I might have to do Coes at some point.
Stick him in as number four for this series.
Coes,
Cool.
Yeah.
Okie dokie. Well, As always, we'd like to thank you for listening and hope that you will listen to our next podcast, whenever that might be. We'd like to thank our friend Nick, who always gives us technical advice.
Hope he's recovered. He's had a nasty sickness bug.
Recently been ill and he's moved. It's all very exciting. So all he's changed. Got lots of stuff going on. But thank you, as always, to Nick, giving up his time to sort this out. And please follow us, as always, on Twitter and Instagram at economicsin10, or contact us by email at economicsin10@gmail.com. We also recently had someone just give us a few corrections on Facebook, and you know, for many people, I think we'd kind of be stung by, but we liked it.
We liked it
because it's good, isn't it? When the facts change, go back to Keynes.
When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do?
Exactly.
So I think, in our monetary special, we mentioned base rates.
Yes.
And the sort of more common parlance now is bank rate. And I think also we were in the dark about what the Federal Reserve Bank's main target was. And I think it was
2% in the long run.
Yeah, 2% in the long run. And we hadn't picked up on that nuance in the sort of Fed's policy.
So, Owen
Burt?
Owen. So thank you, Owen, for pointing that out. And please keep on pointing out the areas.
We love an email. We love a correction. We love a bit of banter. Just some interest in our podcast.
Yeah, lovely.
All is good.
Thank you.
And if you want to review us on iTunes,
even better.
All the better. The good reviews tickle our ego, the bad ones make us laugh. So thank you for listening.